This is Jeff Blankford. My guest of Takes on the World, Professor Andrew Bacevich, is Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University. A graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, he received his PhD in American Diplomatic History from Princeton. Before joining the faculty of Boston University, he taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins. Professor Bacevich has been one of the most perceptive as well as prolific critics of U.S. military policy in this century, having authored 6 books on the subject, including The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War, American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers in Their Country, and most recently, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, and he's also edited 2 others. His essays and reviews have appeared in a wide variety of scholarly and general interest publications, as well as the nation's leading newspapers, and most recently, online for Times Dispatch, where I read the essay I'm going to discuss with him today. Still Waiting, a Harvey Weinstein Moment for America's Wars, which ends with a question mark. It's a subject that resonates with me, and one I have mentioned on past programs, the absence of any semblance of an anti-war movement at a time of endless U.S. wars. Welcome, Professor Bacevich, to Takes on the World.
Well, thanks very much.
You know, while I called you on the phone, I played again for our listeners Phil Oakes' I Ain't Marching Anymore, a classic ballad of the anti-war movement. Here, an article asking, where is the anti-war movement today? Where is this Harvey Weinstein moment? Raises the question, where are the protests against America's wars? With all the information highway, with all the information we get on the internet, are there any simple answers?
No, I don't think there are any simple answers, but I think there are several factors. One of those factors, I think, is the Trump presidency and the way that the preoccupation with Trump as an individual and with his antics, I think has made it more difficult to interest people in a discussion of how we got Trump in the first place. That is to say, what are the underlying problems, concerns that result in somebody manifestly unqualified to be president, to get elected president. So I think that's one factor. I think a second factor, of course, is our military system. That is to say, our reliance on a professional military, which has resulted in a profound disengagement on the part of the American people generally from foreign policy broadly and from our wars more generally, because we don't have any particular a stake in what's going on. We don't have any stake because we don't serve, and we don't have any stake because we don't even pay for these wars. They just get we just keep running up the tab with some expectation that future generations are somehow going to end up paying the bills. I think a third factor is the absence of an alternative. You know, we the two parties take turns in running the country, at least in terms of the presidency, and both of them are committed to a set of propositions with regard to America's role in the war that end up eliminating any serious debate. You know, we've got two parties, both of them committed to so-called global leadership, both of them persuaded that having and using military power is the key to exercising leadership. So there's a lot of yapping that goes on in Washington, but on matters related to national security, the yapping doesn't result in people being presented with two distinctive choices. It's just the same thing from both parties, in my view.
Well, there's an irony there. There was a moment when President Obama ran as an anti-war candidate, and when he was elected, I think his anti-war credentials were far overstated, but people wanted to believe in them. One of the first acts he took was to pardon, well, in my turn, was to say the nation had to look forward, not backward, effectively pardoning the Bush administration responsibility for launching a war in Iraq that was illegal and committed with false information, whereas Britain had four or five investigations about how it got into the war. The United States has had none, and there was no demand for it on the part of the public. In effect, that allowed those who were responsible for creating and destabilizing the Middle East, creating what I believe is the refugee problem, that all the problems stem from that war, to get away scot-free. And Americans didn't look back and say to President Obama, we need to have an investigation. There was no demand for that. This is even before Donald Trump. What would your comment be about that?
Well, I think you're largely correct. I mean, I don't believe that everything that has gone wrong in the Islamic world since 2003 is a result of the U.S. invasion that year. But I sure think a lot of the things that have gone wrong stem from that needless war. But more to the point you're making, I think I agree with it. There has been no accountability. I just had an exchange, email exchange with a friend of mine. I'd annoyed him by something that I had written, and I think that the nexus of his annoyance and our disagreement was that he very much is cognizant of the danger posed by Trump and his administration, and I agree with him on that, but he is not willing, in my view, to acknowledge the extent to which things that happened well before Trump have helped to create this mess that we are in, and I think that the center of the root cause is a misperception, again shared by both parties, certainly shared by everybody, not everybody, most people in the national security establishment, a misperception of the implications of the Cold War coming to an end, and a resulting wild exaggeration about the efficacy of American military power. So we, as soon as the Cold War ended, we started throwing our weight around militarily. We embarked upon a pattern of armed intervention. Again, to emphasize, presidents of both parties supporting this. And down to the present moment, there has been no accounting. It's not simply that there was no serious evaluation of why we invaded Iraq, although you're right, there was none. But there's not been any serious evaluation of the misuse of American military power over the past quarter century and what it has yielded. And you say, well, why has that not happened? And I think because we've got Democratic fingerprints all over this thing, and we've got Republican fingerprints all over this thing, and frankly, we get the media fingerprints all over this thing. I mean, certainly, you know, if the mainstream media is embodied in print publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post, well, we would say both of those newspapers have been cheerleaders for American intervention for some time. So there's nobody that has any real clout or authority who's willing to undertake this critical assessment of our policies. There's lots of individuals, you know, journalists and scholars, professors, people who have radio shows, but I don't. I'm sorry to say that their efforts don't amount to much more than simply some chatter that doesn't affect the politics of our country.
Well, an example of this was the current issue of Time magazine that came out just before the end of the year, the January 1st edition. And on the cover, it says 2018, the year ahead, and there is not a word in the magazine about America's wars. Not a word.
I had not seen that. I mean, it's sort of amazing, but I guess it's also emblematic of where things stand.
Well, there's an article on the refugees, but it doesn't make the connection between the Iraq War or the intervention in Libya, which another disaster. There's no analysis, there's no discussion, and sadly, there doesn't seem to be any demand for one on the part of any sector of the public, at least significant segment of the public, that could raise these issues. We, during the war in Vietnam, without the internet and without cell phones, people organized large demonstrations. But again, as you say, people had skin in the game. There was a military draft. And I have to say a mistake we made was our demand during the intervention, during the Vietnam War, was stop the draft. And we got our request fulfilled by President Nixon. I had been a draftee before that, before the war. But this was a situation in which we did not see what it implied and what had, after 17 years, the Iraq War, the first Iraq War began, and people began to actually pay no attention. This is what it's been up to this point. And there's no going back on that, is there?
Well, I don't. I despair. I don't think so. I mean, you know, it's striking to me. So here we are, as you have just indicated, sort of caught in this circumstance where wars never seem to end. Here we are with a president who came to office unprepared for the presidency, and consistently shooting off his mouth in the most irresponsible way. Others have noted, his approval rankings for a president at the end of his first year are the lowest of anybody ever. One would think that that the time would be ripe for leaders to emerge from the Democratic Party who would make the argument, you know, elect me president. Here's what I will bring to the table. Here's how I will undo the damage that Trump has caused. Here's how I will address the problems that Trump inherited, such as our permanent wars. So it seems like that the field is wide open for national debate, dialogue, and yet the Democratic Party has not produced any such figure as far as I can tell. Maybe there's discussions behind closed doors, but the silence of the Democratic Party in terms of providing a fundamental critique, not a critique amongst details, but a fundamental critique about our post-Cold War foreign policy, the silence is really deafening.
And also, it doesn't seem with the organizations that have supported Bernie Sanders, for example, Our Revolution, the Resistance, and so on, they all seem to be focusing on domestic issues, ignoring the war. And one interesting thing is that the only issues concerning the military and what our role in the world is has been support of women being allowed to be in combat. There's an organization devoted to that, and also transgenders in the military and how important that is. But there's no analysis or even discussion of what the military role is in the world. It's kind of like this seems to be more like cannon fodder without thinking about it, and it's bewildering. That there's no, it's like a barrier to really examining U.S. role in the world. Even as you mentioned in an article, Donald Trump has escalated what Obama had escalated already in terms of the use of drones all over the world, predator drones. We have predators in Hollywood, predators in New York, predators on Fox News. But the most dangerous predators are the ones that have been killing people at the orders of the U.S. president.
Yeah, I mean, you were very kind to mention some of the books that I've written over the last, I guess it's about a decade and a half now. And truth to tell, I think I've sort of, in some respects, not in every respect, I've sort of written the same darn book, 10 different times, trying to call attention to this self-destructive pattern of behavior that we have followed, and it doesn't do any good. I mean, maybe my books aren't sufficiently persuasive, but I'm simply reflecting that the efforts to articulate a critique that's going to resonate just doesn't happen. And your reference to the Time magazine that you know surveys the year behind and the year ahead and doesn't even mention our wars, I think is a good example of the problem. War has become normal, and therefore it doesn't get discussed.
And doesn't sell magazines. No, your books, and I've interviewed once before about one of your books, and I have a couple of others. They're out there. It's not that the information is not available to the public to discuss it. It's there is a kind of a turning in of society, more narcissistic in a certain way. People taking selfies of themselves, addicted to the technology. And I've observed that the gap between information and knowledge today is probably wider than it's ever been. We're overloaded with information, and there's a lack of knowledge and ability to act on it.
Is an argument. There's an argument made by serious people that one of the effects of our infatuation with our electronic devices is to shorten our attention span, and also I think encourage this narcissism of me and what I'm doing and what I want to share with my followers. So there is something about the information age that contributes to this unwillingness to think critically and to attend to first-order questions. But, a lot of people are making a lot of money in promoting all of that stuff, and as long as that's the case, the people who warn against it are, they're not going to be listened to.
My guest is Professor Andrew Bacevich. We're talking about a recent article, which was entitled "The Harvey Weinstein Moment for America's War is Still Waiting," a question mark. The way the movement that developed over very rapidly after the exposure of Harvey Weinstein was like something like waiting to happen. And it's been quite exhilarating and something that needed to happen. But it's almost like we've closed the borders of our mind that what happens in this country is what counts, that people are, not just sexual oppression, but people are actually dying, as you pointed out. The America's wars are actually killing people. And American taxpayers are at least supporting that, is being with deficit spending, whatever. We have a certain responsibility. We don't hold our elected officials. We don't even pay any attention to how they vote. We don't even know how they vote unless we subscribe to some kind of a voting report, because this is not, the votes are not reported in our local newspapers. It's like Time magazine is responding to the reality. People don't care. They want to put stuff in their magazines that people will read, and the advertisers are interested in that as well. It's like they've tuned out America's role in the world completely.
Well, I think there's something to that. If you want to sell magazines, I guess issues related to race and gender and sexuality have a currency that has led to them gaining far greater attention than would have been the case 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago. And one could certainly argue that's not a bad thing, it's a good thing, because issues related to race, gender, and sexuality are important. some respects are, you know, cut to the core of who we are and what we want our society to be. But those concerns haven't added to concerns about other things like what we're doing with our military in the world, but they've served to displace these other issues. And that's a problem. I mean, as a reader of the New York Times, I'm always struck by the emphasis given to, particularly in the Times, given to issues that relate to sexuality. And they certainly don't ignore foreign affairs, but there is a emphasis that it seems to me results in the public not paying as much attention to foreign policy, national security policy, as it ought to.
This is, again, it brings back the situation where when there was a draft, everyone who had a member of their family, they had almost nobody didn't have somebody in their family, either a son or a father or a brother, that wasn't somehow either serving or possibly serving or in jeopardy to serve. You had whole movements develop. And now, if you ask the average teenager, 17 or 18 year old teenager, and I've seen many of them, I've talked to many of them, they have no idea. If you mention Yemen, they have no idea where it is on the map. You've mentioned Afghanistan, they give you a blank look. They're not physically or genetically different, I don't believe, than students were back in the day. I remember there was one day in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, where all the high schools and middle schools in San Francisco and down the peninsula went out on strike, organized by themselves against the war in Vietnam. It not reported anywhere in any school textbook, so unless someone was there or heard about it, it's evaporated in history. But I've told kids about this, kids just like themselves, and there's no link there because it's another, you know, it's like talking about Martin Luther King in the 60s, the civil rights movement, you get blank stares. They've been cut off from a history that is taught to them in ways to, so they pass the state history test but don't know anything about their history. It's a problem, a societal problem, not just dealing with the anti-war movement, with a lack of an anti-war movement, but with our history in general. And how do you find that at the university level?
Well, I'm not teaching anymore because I retired teaching.
Yes.
But I think your point's a good one, and I think that the Trump phenomenon reinforces it. I mean, it is almost as if anything that happened before Election Day, November 2016, no longer matters. And that the only thing that matters is Trump and what he says and what he's doing. So he's just sucked the oxygen out of everything. And history, I think, is fallen by the wayside. I mean, circle back to the exchange we had a few moments ago about the utter absence of any serious accountability. Yes, about the Iraq War, but more broadly about all of our wars. They start, they continue. Once in a while, they end or get suspended and then resume. But there's simply no serious effort to pose the question, "Hey, what's going on here?" So in the realm of national security, events take on a momentum of their own, and things just continue to happen. It's amazing. Even with Trump, you know, when Trump was running, he actually ran as a critic of our post 9/11 wars, promised in his typical way that elect me and I'll either win them or we'll get out. And in fact, what he's done is make some minor tweaks to what Obama was already doing. The tweaks tend to be in the form of escalations, and so the wars continue. I mean, one could argue that we've achieved real success against the Islamic State, not in eliminating ISIS as a movement, but at least in eliminating the Islamic State as a territorial entity. Where that's going to go, I wouldn't even pretend to know. But when you look at Afghanistan, it's 17 years of war, and we're just sort of trying harder, hoping that something might turn up. And in that sense, Trump has not delivered on what he told his followers he was going to do.
Well, he says something's different. Now we're fighting to win. I mean, military officers must shake their head, statements like that.
Well, when you he has said that, and of course he never explains what that means, but his commander, General Nicholson, who's got to be like the 15th commander, U.S. commander in Kabul, has defined what winning means, and what winning means is to basically negotiate, to try to bring the Taliban to the table, quote unquote, and then to hammer out some sort of agreement that's going to end hostilities. And believe me, I'm all for that. If we could negotiate an end to the war in Afghanistan, but I don't see any reason to believe that what the Trump administration is doing is going to result in that outcome. What they're doing basically is handing Nicholson a handful of more troops and giving him a freer hand to use air power in order to pummel the Taliban into some sort of submission. Nicholson's predecessors tried the same thing, and it didn't work.
And now he's started a war of words with Pakistan, which is essential to carry out that war in Afghanistan, is the U.S. alliance with Afghanistan. And he acts as if we're just giving Afghanistan a lot of money as a big favor for them, and that we should cut it off. But our relationship with Pakistan is a very strange one, but it's certain, to put it mildly.
Yeah. I mean, our relationship, the president is, the president's apparent belief that he can make some threats to withhold money and that that's going to bring Pakistan in line, my guess is that that's going to prove to be remarkably naive. That said, the president and his spokespersons are exactly right that the U.S.-Pakistan relationship has been utterly dysfunctional. He is absolutely right in saying that the Pakistani security establishment has been playing a double game for years, simultaneously supporting the terrorists, the Taliban that we're fighting against, and at the same time expecting vast sums of money from the United States in return. So Trump didn't inherit this dysfunction. It's been going on for quite a long time, and I think is yet one more clear indicator of how misguided our policies have been. You know, what is it that has brought us to this circumstance where we give on an annual basis many, many hundreds of millions of dollars a year to a country that is, for all practical purposes, run by the military, it's the Pakistani Army and Intelligence Service that call the shots in that place. So we're giving them this money at the same time that they're supporting the people that we're supposedly fighting against. I mean, I don't mean to imply that somehow there's some simple resolution. I have none. But certainly that is one illustration of how screwed up our policies have come to be.
Well, you know, you look at the globe, and One of the things that's always kind of puzzled me is why there's been never any question about the way the United States government, the military, view the globe, and in which the whole entire globe is broken down into commands.
Right.
Nobody even discusses that. Well, I remember when they started AFRICOM, African Command, very mm-hmm. small. Bush started that. They couldn't really find a base for it in Africa, so it's actually based in Germany. But President Obama took that AFRICOM and spread it all over the continent with actually no discussion, hardly any reporting on what was going on. So when four U.S. soldiers are killed in Niger, even members of Congress expressed surprise by what they were doing there. There's no discussion about this in the U.S. media, unless something like that happens in Niger, that the U.S. has this idea that the whole world is something that the United States can command militarily or has an interest in militarily. Much as I mentioned earlier, General Mattis is talking about sending diplomats and civilians and contractors to Syria, and the NPR reports on it, but there's no question, what is the United States doing in Syria? What's the authorization for that? And I guess it's the authorization after 9/11.
That's correct. I mean, people do talk about this, but again, it's sort of idle talk. That is to say that we are engaged in these myriad military actions hither and yon, and the administration, successive administrations, this is not a Trump invention, cite the authorization to use military force that was passed by the Congress right after 9/11 as a blanket authorization to do anything anywhere. It's absurd. There have been some members of Congress who have, carefully raised their hand and said, well, maybe that's not such a good thing. But as a practical matter, the Congress has forfeited to the executive branch the authority to decide when and where the U.S. forces are going to go fight. And I myself think that is evidence of the cowardice of the Congress, of its willingness to simply allow the Constitution in that regard to be gutted. It's reprehensible, and it is not serving the country well. They need to step up and reassert their authority in that regard, and there's almost no indication that they have the political courage to do so.
Well, the War Powers Act of 1973 was designed to correct that a similar problem that existed at that time, but now the problem is even worse. And there was, I remember during the Obama administration, there were some Democrats who said there should be a new vote or that authorization, but you don't hear anything about it anymore, at least in the media.
I think you're correct. You don't hear anything. And again, I'd simply reassert the point that it's because they lack the courage to take responsibility. It's a lot easier politically to let the president do whatever the president wants to do, and then if things go badly, the loss of the soldiers in Niger is an example. It's a lot easier then for members of the Senate Armed Services Committee, in the wake of that incident, to say, "Oh gosh, we don't know where U.S. forces are." Yeah, well, you don't know because you don't pay attention to where they are. And the Congress pays no penalty whatsoever for allowing the chief executive to exercise this free hand to wage war whenever and wherever he wants to.
As you mentioned before, this is not a Republican problem; it's a problem of both parties. Again, we've hear about various people who are going to run for presidency on the Democratic ticket campaigning, and I haven't heard, at least I haven't read, anything about getting out of U.S. wars.
I agree. I mean, back to my earlier point, it just, as an outsider, I'm not involved in partisan politics, but it seems like the time is ripe for some Democrat to step forward to articulate a clear and courageous critique of U.S. policy and to offer an alternative. But that individual has yet to identify himself or herself.
We're coming down to the end of the hour. Not a very depressing is to put it mildly, and I'm laughing rather than crying, or smiling rather than crying. What do you see as the prospects for the remainder of the year? I mean, you have been writing the books. You're providing the information, the tools for people to use. All they have to do is pick them up. What do you see as the prospects for the coming year?
Well, I think broadly speaking, it's more of the same. For anybody who wants to look at the administration's national security strategy that came out about 2 weeks ago, there's a certain amount of Trumpian rhetoric about America First. But in terms of specifics, there's going to be no significant change in our global posture. The president wants to spend more money on the military, wants to have it be bigger and stronger and better in more places. I think the concern is the danger of unintended war with Korea as the most likely place. A war in Korea would be, I think almost all observers agree, would be a disaster. And yet we've got leaders on both sides that do not appear to be particularly stable and do not appear to understand the possible consequences of their reckless rhetoric. I think there's a lesser chance for wars in and around the Persian Gulf, particularly as we ratchet up our anti-Iran rhetoric. Those are the two things I'm most concerned about.
At that point, we're going to say goodbye, and thank you so much, Andrew Bacevich, for being our guest again today on Takes on the World.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. This is Jeff Blankford, and thank you for listening.